like to introduce Shoryu Jim Redley. He's a Dharma brother of mine for over 10 years. Now we practiced here together many years ago at Austin Zen Center, and both left, and today we come back together again.
Yep.
So, welcome back, Shoryu.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Well, good morning again. It's good to be here in Austin. I love Austin. I'll tell you just a little bit more about myself before I start, because you might be wondering a little bit more about who exactly I am. First, I'm going to get a drink of water. I grew up in College Station. Actually, don't hold it against me. and I went to A&M, actually, Texas A&M, but I did come over here to Austin and go to graduate school some years later, so I feel that kind of makes up for my earlier life here to you Austinites. In graduate school, I started practicing Zen, and I was ordained here with Barbara Cohn some years ago, and went to practice at Atasahara for a while. And then, with Barbara's blessing, in 2004, I went up to Bloomington, Indiana, to study with my current teacher, Shohaku Okamura Roshi. And I studied with him there for 5 years. We did a five-year training, and then he kind of set me free, and I spent some time in Virginia after that, and I've spent some time in California at Yokoji doing a practice period there, and a little bit of time in Japan too recently. And now I'm back in Austin, and I'm happy to be here. I love Austin. Every time I come, I just feel like I'm at home, so it's great to be here. This morning, I would like to talk about samsara and nirvana. And first, I'll start out with just a quote here from the Lankavatara Sutra. Let me read that. Conditions of existence are not of mutually exclusive character. In essence, things are not two, but one. Even nirvana and samsara, their world of life and death, are aspects of the same thing. For there is no nirvana except where is samsara, and samsara where there is nirvana. All duality is falsely imagined. So this is a pretty common teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. We hear it a lot. But what exactly does it mean? You know, Buddhism is a very practical tradition, I think. For me, it's not so much about theories as what does this have to do with our life? How do we live our life? So I think Buddhism is just that. How do we live our life? So I'd like to talk about this samsara and nirvana being one. And to begin with, I'll talk first of all about the theory a little bit, since I just said that that's not what it's about, but sometimes it's helpful a little bit to talk about the theory. And one way we can present this is through the teaching of the four Dharma seals. And my Dharma sister here a couple of weeks ago mentioned the four Dharma seals. And what they are basically is just four aspects that if any teaching encompasses these aspects, then we know that that's a teaching of Buddhism. So just briefly, the Dharma seals are: all life, of course, contains suffering. That's the first one. The second one is that everything is impermanent. The third one, that everything lacks independent existence. Or sometimes you hear no self. And the fourth seal is nirvana. So if a teaching contains all of these seals, then we can say that they're a teaching of Buddhism. I like to present these teachings the way that my teacher did. And he actually mixes the order up a little bit. And he talks about Dharma seal 2 and 3 first, because he considers those as a description of reality. And Dharma seals 1 and 4 are the way that we face that reality, or the way that we practice with that reality. So, briefly, everything is impermanent is Dharma Seal 2. Pretty self-explanatory. The Buddha taught that everything in our life is just a matter of different elements coming together for some time. They seem to stay for a while and then they break apart. But nothing is substantial. There's nothing eternal that we can depend on to last forever. Lack of independent existence, or no self. The Buddha taught this actually as anatman, is the Sanskrit word. And basically this means that none of us, or no thing that we can encounter, can exist on its own. Everything exists only in relationship to something else, or everything else actually. So Dharma Seal 1 is the truth of suffering. So when we don't face these first two truths of reality, then our life becomes suffering. Basically, that's what the Buddha taught. So this samsara, this transmigration through different realms of existence, as classical Buddhism taught, can really be, we can really relate that to our everyday life, because actually the classical teaching talked about this transmigration in different realms over and over again, lifetime after lifetime. But we can look at that actually as a description of the way that we encounter our current life. When we approach life with the attitude that we're a separate person, that we have a self that is independent, and basically we try to satisfy the needs of that self, and we try to push away the things that that self doesn't like, that's when we create samsara. Because basically nothing is permanent, there's nothing we can hold on to, and anything we gain in this lifetime, sooner or later, we're going to lose. So this samsara, this transmigration, is actually the up and down quality of our daily life. Sometimes we're happy when we feel like we're satisfied. Sometimes we feel like we're in hell when we're angry and we don't get what we want. Sometimes we feel self-righteous that we have to fight and we have to have justice. Sometimes we feel that we can't be satisfied. We're in the hungry ghost realm. So this is samsara, being sort of a slave to our own thoughts and emotions. And the Buddha taught that nirvana, in our understanding of it in Soto Zen, we talk about nirvana as a way of life rather than a particular state of mind or a place that we get to. Nirvana is facing the two realities that we talked about here just a moment ago, of impermanence and no self, or emptiness actually. In Buddhism we call this emptiness, impermanence and no independent self. So nirvana is living with that reality and aspiring to awaken to that reality. So the Buddha taught that the problem here of why we usually face our life in this realm of samsara is attachment. And basically it's attachment to things that please us or things we don't like, or more fundamentally, our thoughts and feelings about those things that we like or that we don't like. So it's really our thoughts and our emotions that drag us around in this realm of samsara. Sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're sad. If we're just stalking our inbox, you know, our box of me and who I am with borders, with things outside of ourselves, we suffer because those things are changing all the time and we can't hold on to those things. So basically it's the discursive mind, the mind that thinks and grasps onto things as real and defines them as permanent, that causes our suffering. So we could say that basically our thinking is the problem. But it's not a problem because we need to get rid of thinking. Thinking is not a bad thing. We all need to think. It's very necessary for our life to think. But the problem is when we associate our thinking with reality, when we mistake our thinking with truth, that's the problem. And that's usually what we do. Because the regular thinking mind, for some reason, is set up so that it splits reality into subject and object. I'm here, you're there. I want to be your friend or I don't like you. I want to have my relationship with you go the way that I want it to go. That's the basic problem. We do this with everything in our life because of the way we think about things. If we put our stock in the thinking mind, if we base our approach of life on the thinking mind. But of course, we have to think. It's what we do as human beings. It's the way that we get things done in life. You have to make choices. You have to go about your life making decisions and trying to do things. So the point is not to get rid of our thinking, but not grasp it. So for us, in Soto Zen, this is why our Zazen practice, our sitting meditation practice, is the center of our life, is the center of our practice. Because in Zazen, we simply sit down within this posture, breathing easily, comfortably, sitting upright. These thoughts and emotions, these karmic tendencies, these biases, these predispositions we have towards life are all coming up through our Zazen. But we just simply let them come up. They come up for a while, they stay, and then they go away, like everything else in life does. So in our Zazen, we simply let them be. We let them run their natural course, and we don't try to grasp them and say, this is real and this is the way I'm going to conduct my life because this thing is real. So this simple practice is the foundation of our meditation practice and our practice outside of the Zendo as well. So ideally what we try to do is root our life in Zazen, in this letting things be and not grasping. And we hope that that can blossom throughout the rest of our life so that everything we do becomes an expression of Zazen. So that we're not invested in what we do in this idea of separation, but we can let go of those ideas of separation or those ideas of desire or aversion and simply do what needs to be done and express truth. So that is, I think, the basic definition of, for me, of the difference between samsara and nirvana, is that it's a simple shift in attitude. Uchama Roshi, my teacher's teacher, had a lovely way of expressing it, I think. He called this opening the hand of thought in Zazen, this thing that we do, of just letting go and letting things be as they are. And he said that we could do that outside of the Zendo as well, too. Of course, the difference is that we have to make decisions and we have to do things. So we can't just ignore the reality of life. We have to watch the traffic light so that we can discriminate and go when it's green. So it's not the same, it's not exactly the same thing, but how do we keep this attitude of living with the essential qualities of life, of emptiness, of interconnection and impermanence while we make those decisions? The great Zen master Dogen Zenji, who founded this school, the Soto school in Japan, in medieval Japan, talked about this process in a writing called the Tenzo Kyokun, which is a instructions for the cook of a monastery. But he used that instruction for that cook as like a metaphor for how we take care of our life. But Uchama Roshi talked about this writing, and he commented on the three different minds that are presented in this writing. There's three different minds that Dogen Zenji said that we should practice with in our daily life, and these are an expression of our Zazen in daily life. He talked about magnanimous mind, nurturing mind, and joyful mind. So the way Uchama Roshi talked about this was he said that magnanimous mind is the mind of Zazen, is the mind that welcomes everything and doesn't discriminate. It's the mind of the mountain that lets all beings come and settle and live there peacefully. So when we use this, or we invite this mind, or we let this mind arise in our life outside of the Zendo, there's the realization that everything in our life is ourself, and that from this place, nurturing mind arises. You are my life. Everything I encounter is my life, so I want to care for you as I care for my own life. And from there, the joyful mind, the joy in just practicing, arises. So this is the expression of nirvana, I would say, in our daily life, of taking care of our life, our shared life with all beings. So I'd like to give you a quote from Kodo Sawaki Roshi, who is my Dharma great-great-grandfather, I guess. He said, "Heaven and earth give themselves. Air, water, plants, animals, and humans give themselves to each other. It is in this giving themselves to each other that we actually live. The world in which people give and receive things without saying, 'Give it to me,' is the truly beautiful world. It differs from the world of scrambling for things. It is vast and boundless." So the world here that Sawaki Roshi was talking about, I think, was this world of opening the hand of thought, the world that is always there when we let go of our idea of what it is and let it manifest through our own life. It is actually the world of impermanence and lack of independent existence or emptiness. It is the world of emptiness. This world in which all things give and receive together as one body without being concerned about individuality or universality, but simply expressing life. So other names for this world are nirvana, Indra's net, emptiness, the network of interdependent origination. That's what my teacher calls it. Pure Land Buddhists might call it Amida Buddha's compassion. Some of us might call it grace, or simply life. So the air that we breathe, the water that we sustain our bodies with, the warmth and light that we receive from the Son. They're all gifts from this world of impermanence and lack of independent existence. So I think it's our natural state to live in accordance with this world of giving and receiving. But because human beings can think, we need to make effort to practice. Birds and frogs and insects seem to be able to practice pretty easily. This is sort of the teaching too, that all things are actually practicing together. This is original enlightenment, that everything is practicing together. But we as human beings need to put effort into opening the hand of thought so that we can accord with this original enlightenment or this world of giving and receiving. Yet so often, usually we go through life with this sort of mentality of we have a stock, we have a boundary that we need to protect very precisely and defend, and that if we get enough inside the inbox, in the boundary, then things are going well. But if we look in the inbox and not as much is there, there's too much going out, and the depletion is happening on the inbox, we get upset and suffer. And that's the usual way. That's the problem with basing our lives on this discriminating thinking and emotions, emotional kind of roller coaster. But samsara, that's samsara. Nirvana is simply expressing our life in accordance with the reality that we're sharing it with all beings and all things. So I wanted to read a little piece that I found in a publication called 30,000 Days, and it's put out by a place called the Todo Institute in Vermont. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about the Todo Institute in just a second. And this is a piece by Geshe Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, obviously a Tibetan teacher. So one of my first experiences of culture shock in America was at my friend's house. We were hungry and we opened their big refrigerator at 11 o'clock at night. You only see these huge refrigerators in the U.S. And it had a deep freezer also. We didn't go that far. The fridge was enough. There was so much food in there. And the person who opened the fridge said, "Oh, there's no food in there. We'll need to go to the store." For a moment, I was in total shock. At first, I thought maybe something was wrong with my eyesight. How is it possible that we're looking at the same fridge and this person is seeing no food where I am seeing so much? Of course, when we went out to shop, I saw they bought a few things that were missing. But where I grew up, whatever was left over from breakfast became lunch. And with the leftover lunch, we made dinner. If an onion was missing, we didn't skip the whole dinner plan. So we can make use of this example. When you open the fridge, it is like you are opening your life. When you open your life, you have the opportunity to see that life is full. Or you can open it and see, an onion is missing. My life is empty. It is so wonderful, the absence of that. Oh, it is so powerful, the absence of that onion. Clearly in our eyes clearly in our lives we have experiences like this. The feeling of abundance or not, regardless of what we have or do not have. One of the greatest experiences I had in my life was with a few Tibetans who had just come from Tibet. They didn't have anything, but I went to visit their room. And they said, "Oh, come in." They were so happy that I was visiting them in their room. They said, "Let's have something." Of course, it was the opposite experience of looking in the fridge. There really was nothing. Just one plate of leftover fried bread that was a week old and some boiled water. They offered it to me saying, "Have something." At first, when they said, "Have something," I thought there would be something. They got out the dried bread and put a glass of water and offered it to me in front of me. But the amazing thing was the joy. There was so much joy and generosity through offering that dried bread and boiled water. It was truly an amazing experience. So, I think that's a good example of the way that a subtle way that we perceive things or attach to things can be the difference between the expression of samsara or the expression of nirvana in our life. I wanted to talk about one other thing briefly, it looks like now. I don't have a lot of time to express this. Something that could use a lot of expression that I think is a deep practice, but I wanted to just mention it because I've been interested since I've left Bloomington in studying ways that we can open the hand of thought, you know, outside of the Zendo. And of course, there's the tradition in Buddhist teachings and Buddhist study to study and teachings and reflect basically on our life. So what are ways that we can reflect and study our own life to help us open the hand of thought and see beyond the missing onion? As I was saying earlier, I've been in contact with the Todo Institute recently. I've been doing a little bit of studying there with them, and one of the things they, well, I should say, basically what they do there is they offer Japanese psychology. They have sort of imported these ancient teachings of Japanese psychologies and put them in a framework that's more accessible to Western people. And one of the practices that they do there is called Nikon, which means roughly looking inside, or maybe seeing oneself with the mind's eye is a more poetic way of putting it. And Nikon is based on just three simple questions that you ask yourself in relationship to any relationship. Could be your daily life. Basically, fundamentally, the basic practice of Nikon is a daily reflection in which we ask these three questions. But you can do this reflection with any relationship, with your family, your spouse, your work, United States, any institution, anything that you have a relationship with in your life. So the three questions are, what have I received? What have I given, and what troubles have I caused? And what's interesting to me about this practice is that actually, when you think about it, it's sort of the inbox, outbox mentality. You know, it's sort of the balance sheet mentality, which is the problem usually. But it actually shows us that our delusions are dharma gates, and when we enter them deeply, they actually show us the truth, or at least this one does, I think. It shows that the underlying assumptions of the inbox, outbox, balance sheet philosophy is fundamentally flawed. So the first question, what have I received from my life? Usually I'll do this at the end of the day or early in the morning. What have I received? And usually, you know, we sort of go through our day taking for granted the little things, the so-called little things that are actually not so little, the little things that are great gifts in our life. Bear with me, I'd like to read one other quote, because I think Uchama Roshi puts it very well, relating here to something similar to the first question. Uchama Roshi says, in the Bible it says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them falls into the ground apart from the will of your Father. He studied Christian philosophy, so he used a lot of Christian examples, actually. 99.99% of our necessities come from a gift from heaven and earth, from the 10,000 things, from the universe. But 0.01% of the things we need can become objects of greed. Air, light, temperature, water, etc. All these things which we have received since our birth are not only indispensable to human life, but they are blessings. Only when we see that even though we have never rendered any service to the universe, but we have nevertheless received immeasurable blessings without which we could not survive, only then we diminish our greed toward that 0.01% of our necessities and live our lives with a sincere intention to do whatever we can for everything and everybody. Only then shall we find the vast, calm way of life in front of us. So I think this is what the first question is about. Often is it's about anything, of course. It may be different for you, but for me, it's about seeing a bit more clearly this vast universe of offering. The next question, what have I given? What have I given to my life in the last, or others, or whatever, whoever I might encounter, in the last 24 hours? Usually, we go through life, or we go through the day often, sort of focusing on what we can get out of it. What are we owed? Why did she talk to me that way? Why didn't my boss give me the raise? Or why was the pizza delivered late? You know, why didn't the car start? We tend to focus on those things. But it's what a much more healthy and easy way to go through life or go through your day, looking at it as an opportunity to repay your debt of gratitude. What can I do? What can I offer? You know, whether it's just helping somebody who's really in need or doing small things like replacing a roll of toilet paper that someone forgot to replace. This can make your life, or this can make my life meaningful, or my day meaningful. So I think this attitude is the key difference between the attitude of samsara, you know, what can I get, and nirvana, what can I offer? The last question, what troubles have I caused? Usually we're quite good at seeing the troubles that others cause us. So we don't have that question there. We notice that that's not part of this reflection, because usually we're good at seeing that and we don't need help. But this question, I think, is a way for us to practice really opening the hand of thought, to try to see things through the way someone else might see them, to try to put yourself in someone else's place and let go of your own idea of being correct is opening a form of opening the hand of thought. And it's very essential in Buddhist practice. The ability to say I'm wrong, I mean, it's very essential, but it's a very deep and hard, difficult practice. But the third question, what troubles have I caused, I think, enables us to see things from a different viewpoint than we often see them. So, the last thing I would do then is just briefly share with you a little bit of my own Nikon reflection. And if anyone else is interested in this sort of practice, I can tell you later. I think we have tea later and you can ask me about it, but there's a book about it written by Greg Creech. That's a very good book. I recommend if you're interested in that. So I'm just going to mention a few things that I've encountered over the last couple of days and this morning too. I had the chance to write a few things down. So what did I receive yesterday or last couple of days? Warmth from the sun to sustain my body and life. Air conditioning that enabled my body not to get too hot. A pair of contact lenses that enabled me to visually navigate through the day. Spiritual guidance through a talk given by Dogen Zenji, recorded in an ancient book and translated by my teacher. A neighbor smiled at me while I was taking Bella the dog out for a walk. The beautiful, masterful improvisations of many mockingbirds. The toilet in my home allowed me to take care of my bodily functions conveniently. My shaver shaved my head. My sister went to the grocery store and brought home some food for me to eat. My car took me close to 100 miles this morning without any problem. Quite quickly, too. I had fresh air to breathe all day long. I had a Zendo to sit in this morning. Someone came to the Zendo, opened the door, and turned on the lights this morning and enabled me to sit Zazen. The painted stripes on the road that I drove this morning allowed me to stay safely in my own lane and prevented other drivers from coming into my lane. A person at the grocery store asked me how I was doing, took the money I needed to give the grocery store for my purchase, and smiled and thanked me as I left. The lamp beside my bed instantly offered light when I switched it on, allowing me to read before going to sleep last night. A postal carrier delivered mail to me at my family's house. Some mysterious force kept my heart beating all day and all night, even when I wasn't paying attention to it. So what did I give? I took Bella the dog for a walk. I emptied the dishwasher and put the dishes in the sink, back into the dishwasher. I cared and watered for my plants. I said good morning to two people during my walk. I heated up food for dinner for my dad and I. I worked on a talk that I hope I can make as an offering with the right attitude. I told the person at the coffee shop that they made me a good black eye. What troubles did I cause? I caused the deaths of many insects when I drove here to Austin this morning. Oh, here it is. I used electricity produced from non-renewable resources that can be harmful to the earth yesterday. I put wear on my car by driving it over here. I used some extra hot water to shave. I likely caused someone some distress while I was riding my bike because I didn't make a good stop at a stop sign. At one point in the day, I didn't give my mother full attention during a conversation because I was preoccupied with something I was worried about. And other forms of life had to die so that I could eat. So that's just a small example of the Nikon practice, and I think a way that can help us open the hand of thought in our daily lives. So I might just give one more brief story, if I can make it brief, about what I think this means, the difference between samsara and nirvana in our life. I practiced at Atasahara for some years. That's where I met Kosho, actually. I consider him a good friend from those years. Tassajara, many of you know, has sort of two seasons. One season is this traditional Buddhist practice period for 90 days, and then there's a summer period where people come in and come as guests, and that supports the monastery. The people come in and pay to enjoy the hot springs and stay at the monastery. So sometimes the transition from the practice period to the guest season can be difficult, especially for new students. If you've kind of really been into the quietness and the meditation of the practice period, and then one day all these people come in, it's like people just show up in your backyard and you don't know who they are. And you have a certain way of doing things, and you know they're not doing them the way that they're supposed to do them. Of course, the reality is these people are coming to support you in the monastery, and without them, there could be no monastery. But the work period is a time to get ready for guest season. So a lot of times people come in for just a short period, and they don't really know the formal way of doing things. And the bathhouse during the practice period is a sacred space where it's like a meditation hall where you bathe in silence and you meditate as you know you're bathing. But you might go in during work period and see clothes strewn all over the place and people kind of laughing and shouting. It's and it's okay, it's okay. But if you get stuck like I was that second practice period and sort of being quiet, it can be a little disturbing if you're holding on too tightly. So it's very good practice there because you have to open the hand of thought and not grasp onto a certain way of practice because it changes. And so one time during work period, I think it was after the guests or the work people just started coming, the Zenda was very full. And another thing that's tradition there is that the students get assigned a seat to sit in the Zendo. And I had my setup, in my seat that was very important to me at that time. And if I didn't have that particular setup, I was probably going to have painful zazen or zazen that wasn't up to snuff or something. I hadn't really been sitting that long, to tell you the truth. So it was very important to me to have my cushion in my place. But sometimes when things get so overwhelming to the people in the Zendo, your seat can get given away by mistake, or there might be a mistake as to whether you're going to attend or not. Your seat can be given away. So one day my seat was given away by mistake, and I had to sit somewhere else, and I grumbled about it because I didn't have my seat. And the next day, I remember I'd had a particularly hard day, and it was the end of the day for evening zazen, and I was thinking, man, I hope they can give my seat away because I just want to go have some peace and quiet and not have achy legs because I got a thin cushion. And that particular day, there were tons of people in the Zendo. I think there were 90 people that tried to show up for a Zendo for, the max is out at 60 or so. So I thought, oh man, I bet you my seat's given away. And I looked in. You can look in on the outside of the Zendo on the Angawa. It's called this place outside. You can look in actually and see what's going on. And I peeked in, and sure enough, my seat was given away. And so I immediately started grumbling and making judgments about the person who was assigning the seats. And this is embarrassing to admit this, but it's the truth. And I kept that frame of mind until I got into the Zendo, and then the Eno said to me, "Can you help?" And in that moment, I looked around and I realized, wow, man, there's a lot of things that need to be done here, but she really needs help. And not only that, but isn't it great that 90 people want to come here and sit zazen, express the Dharma? And so that was a shift, a complete shift. A joy in just helping her out arose then. I don't even think I actually got to sit that night because there were so many people. But this joyful mind, I could see arising out of that just engaging yourself, seeing what needs to be done, and doing it, and giving up the sort of little box that we usually, or that we often put ourselves in, of the self, you know, the individual self. So I think that's all I have to say, and my time is finished. So thank you very much, and I really appreciate being here.